Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're back, which is I'm delighted to be coming back to the subject that we did a lot on over the last couple of years, and that's kind of that trauma and how inequality breeds trauma and it denies people social mobility down the line. But before all that, Martin, what's it like being up before 1:30 in the afternoon?
I don't know. I usually get up for Liveline and have a cup of coffee, but this is a weird time of the day, isn't it? Do people do this often?
Some do. It's not most people. Actually, you'd find a small majority, get up early in the morning, send a few tweets, and then go back to bed, but they're only in political life.
Listen, I just want to remind folks that Tortoise Shack, we put a lot of work in this. We put a lot of effort and we're putting out a huge amount of material. So please come on board, be a patron, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Thank you.
Just a bit of housekeeping as well. Obviously, the Vicky Conway podcast Policed is coming soon. Keep an eye on your feeds for that. And we are going to have another live podcast this Sunday where the Tortoise Shack guys will sit down with, I should say guys and gals, because we're outnumbered now, Martin.
We are, thankfully for once, Tony.
Yeah, we're outnumbered now and we don't know who might drop in, but come along. The members make it, so that's the crack. Anyway, enough of my waffle. We are delighted to be joined by lecturer applied psychology from UCC, Dr. Sharon Lambert. Sharon, thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
And thank you so much, and thanks so much to Martin for getting up out of bed so early in the morning. And I do this every morning, Martin. I'm up.
I did. I have kids, but they're more grown up, so I don't really have to take care of them in the mornings anymore.
Yeah, no, I'm still legally required to feed mine.
the state compels it. Sharon, I'm going to start, jump right in. And this is something that I mentioned just before we started recording. I think it's Rachel Keogh's book, Dying to Survive, and then the subsequent play with Grace Dyer's heroine. And they talk about her own real lived experiences and how she was self-medicating. You, in your work, have talked a lot about that. Do you want to just give our listeners an idea of the difference between sort of, that mentality of to use the derogatory terms, that person's a junkie, or, well, actually what the reality is that person is dealing with a trauma?
Yeah, I suppose, we need to really shift our thinking in relation to drug use. It's still really seen as some kind of moral failing. But the reality is that a lot of people in Ireland, a lot of people all over the world, use drugs recreationally. Mm. And, so what we need to look at is, for some people, when they use drugs, it's giving them something that they need more than, going down to the music festival for the weekend and taking a load of drugs and having a great time with your friends and then going back to your reality. And for some people who've experienced a lot of stress and a lot of trauma, using drugs becomes something different, and it becomes something important and something that allows people to be able to control a lot of their emotional distress. We did a study some years ago with Kevin Murphy. He's a clinical pharmacist, where he looked actually at young people who were using a lot of benzodiazepines or tablets. Mm. And the kind of conclusion was, and one of the young people said it, that the reason why he was using them at the level that he was using them at, which obviously got him into a lot of trouble, was because they allowed him to not feel.
Your initial point is important, and it's something we repeat all the time, that not all use is abuse. There are people who take drugs, they go through, I'm going to use that stupid 40-year-old man talking about this. They go through a phase and then they come out of it, and then, but they're not left with any life-altering issues. But there are, and I remember listening to Fergus Finlay speak about it, and you as well, actually, because I do research, folks. But they talk about early childhood experiences and adverse childhood experiences and how they are life limiting down the line. Just throw it to you straight away. Do you want to explain what that means and what it means for people later on in life, how that plays out?
So adverse childhood experiences is a term that's around since the 1990s, and it was first came as a result of a study from the Center for Disease Control in the States. So they were kind of looking at factors that impact on mental health, physical health, and social outcomes. And what they found was that if you had experienced a lot of stress or a lot of adversity during your childhood, that it increased risk. Now, not probability. So there are people who've experienced a huge amount of adversity during childhood, and, you know, they have been lucky enough to have protective factors around them that means that they've been able to, you know, get pushed through these things. But there are other people who've experienced a lot of adversity during their childhood, and it has impacted on them. And there's now thousands of studies from around the world that show that, you know, for some people who've had too much stress at a time when their brain and their body was developing, that it has impacted now on their later life health and well-being. And if you look in homelessness, if you look in prison settings, if you look in juvenile justice, you have people who have higher levels of childhood adversity, significantly higher levels than childhood adversity than you would have in the general population. I suppose what's really important to know, and something that I suppose wasn't around when I started studying psychology first, was there was always a sense that if, you know, somebody had experienced too much stress at a very young age, that there would be damage done that would be irreversible. So, you know, when I started studying psychology, that was kind of the thinking around that. But in the last 12 years, there's been huge advances in brain scanning techniques. So we know that your brain is actually plastic and it has opportunities to wire and change all of the time. So for anybody who is listening, who, you know, experienced a lot of stress when they were children, and who know, you know, that they have, you know, struggles now, maybe with mental health or maybe with using drugs at a level that's really hurting them or people around them, that, you know, recovery from all of that is absolutely achievable.
But I'm right in saying that poverty is the biggest life limiter.
And that's, yeah, and I suppose that's one of the issues I have with the original adverse childhood experience study, was the scored people out of 10, and those 10 questions came exclusively from people's families' home. So it was like, you know, have you ever witnessed violence in the home? You know, have you experienced abuse in the home? Do you have a parent with a mental illness? But there was nothing actually about the societal structural inequalities that actually caused those issues in the first place. So we have known for decades that poverty is the biggest predictor of poor mental health and poor physical health. So you cannot talk about a parent having mental health issues or using drugs or alcohol at a level that's causing them harm without acknowledging their social context. And that's something we're still really poor at. We still blame individuals, even though those individuals have zero choice. And I always say to myself, but for the grace of God, there go I. And if I had to walk in that person's shoes, why wouldn't I use heroin to be able to get me through the day? Particularly people who are experiencing homelessness. If I had to live where I didn't know where I was going to sleep at night, and you have to go through all of the amount of work that's involved in being homeless is a full-time job. Paperwork, appointments, red tape, going from being sent from one office to another, it's incredibly soul destroying. So, you know, it's not fair to talk about family dysfunction and to place all of the blame in the family home if you don't look at the context and what opportunities have you given people for social mobility and what barriers have you put in their way.
I remember John Lonergan, who was the former governor of Mountjoy Prison, and he said that the vast majority of prisoners in Mountjoy had drug-related offences, but also that the vast majority came from just three areas within Dublin. And I know Summerhill was one of the areas he was talking about, but that shows that the predominance of and problematic drug use is confined to, not confined, but largely in areas which are very socioeconomically deprived. John Lonergan knew this 20 years ago, 25 years ago. Are we making any progress on that front at all? Are we looking at it and saying, what can we do? Or is it just ticking over the way it always did?
I think that there's a change coming, Martin. I don't know, maybe if it's because I'm just too selective in the people I follow on social media and I've created some kind of strange bubble for myself where I think there's a revolution happening.
This is called the Echo Chamber podcast.
But I think what I see is that more and more people in positions of power and authority and professional occupations. So if you look at even my own discipline, I'm a psychologist, there is very little diversity in psychology. It's students who make it in psychology tend to have come from very pleasant backgrounds. I'm from a council estate myself. I'm from a working class background. And there aren't that many working class psychologists, but it is changing. And I can see it in more and more areas. And I can see even in psychology, the things that we would have always really operated from kind of a medical model in psychology. And, you know, with my own students in UCC, we now do things in relation to drug use. We have travel cultural awareness training for our students and talking about the impact of racism and prejudice and discrimination on health. So I think the more we have sometimes I used to get mad because I used to think that people just didn't care. Now, and there are people who don't care. Mm. But actually for a lot of people, it's that thing about the contact hypothesis. There are a lot of people who don't know a traveler. There are a lot of people who don't know somebody from a working class background. There are a lot of people who've never actually had a conversation with somebody experiencing homelessness or using drugs. So they get othered. And I think
one of them was the former Taoiseach, current Taoiseach. But that's just my point. I'll say that.
And I'm not nodding in the background or anything. I do think, and even our students this year, every year there's more of a social justice feeling, particularly in young people. I think, you know, if we're relying on the boomers to see us through this, it's not going to happen. I'm kind of tipping into that age category. But when I look at younger people coming up, they're much more politically active and much more in tune with the impact of social inequality and the impact it has on everybody. So, you know, it's not just say, oh, we'll put them all into those flats there. And if they're all really poor and they're all really high and they're dying and they're going to prison, it's not our problem. I think people are realizing that actually it is, and it impacts everybody. It costs a huge amount of money to send somebody to prison. If you invested a smaller amount of money upstream, you would reduce a huge amount of economic cost, social cost, and obviously personal cost. So I'm hopeful. It's the answer to that.
It's a great point, because we always try to make that, and I always make it, and then I get given out to because I go back down to the callous banker in me saying, well, if you're going to make the argument to the people who just think it's their own personal responsibility, you have to say, yeah, but you're paying for it, and it's much cheaper for you who don't want to, who give out about paying taxes every month. It actually works out nearly 3-1 if you spend in prevention as opposed to prison or treatment beds. And sure, you can't get treatment beds for certain, you know, that they're very, very few and far between. Which brings me to one of the phrases you've used, and I just want to say trauma-informed design. I'm reminded of some of the Oireachtas committees that we've seen formed, you know, so we spoke to Susie Byrne, who sits on one now to look at and say disability proof some of the legislation that's coming through, because, you know, we get these things and people go, oh, well, actually that doesn't work, but that will actually, you know, further exclude people who have certain disabilities. There's a lot that in some of the things that we say that we don't acknowledge in terms of either a trauma of poverty or trauma of use and things. Is that, I'm trying to get an understanding. Can you just give me a clear explanation of what you mean by that?
But trauma-informed design. So trauma-informed design is taking what we know from psychology and from neuroscience and applying it to how you design and deliver services. Mm. So, for example, if we take the homelessness community. Not everybody who's there are lots of different reasons why people experience homelessness. So I'm not generalizing here, but for people who are experiencing chronic long-term homelessness, have absolutely no doubt about it that they have experienced trauma, whether that was prior to entering homelessness or during homelessness, because homelessness is a trauma in itself. So what we do then is we think about, well, actually, here's an example. I was watching television recently, and it was one of these weird reality, you know, cop where they follow people around, and a soldier was missing, a former soldier, and he had PTSD. So there was a big conversation about the fact that he'd served, you know, abroad in a war conflict area, that he now had post-traumatic stress disorder. And what did that look like? So he might perceive people as being out to get him, and he might be aggressive. Mm. And you have to be very gentle and very careful, because you have to make sure that you keep him safe. Now, if you take somebody who's experienced homelessness and they've experienced, you know, chronic adversity in their childhood, and now they're a homeless adult, and they may have been exposed to physical violence and sexual violence during homelessness as well, you have somebody who would meet the criteria for PTSD because of their behavior. And when they appear at an appointment and people see them as being challenging, and I hate that word, you know, challenging behavior. And actually what it is it's behavior that allows that person to stay safe, because they have been victimized so frequently that their body takes over and says, you need to be on the defense all the time. You need to be in fight or flight mode.
The genetic imperative.
Yeah. To keep yourself safe, you have to do this. We're just going to automatically kick in your fight or flight system to keep you safe. So a trauma-informed service at its most basic level understands that. So you don't exclude. So if somebody comes up and you, and they're getting agitated because they have to fill in a form, and they start saying, you know, fuck this, and they throw the form on the ground, that your immediate response isn't, that behavior is unacceptable to me, you're now excluded from the service. So what a trauma-informed service does is it takes a step back and it says, I wonder what that behavior is about. Clearly this person is struggling in this moment. It's not personal. And what could I do differently so that they can access our service better? The amount of services that complain about service users not using the service. And like, if I set up a private company, if I set up a little, you know, holiday village here in North Cork, and I advertised it and nobody came to use it as a private service, I would take a step back and I'd say, it's not working. They're not coming. There's something wrong with the service. We need to redesign it. But with some of the services, particularly state services, that are set up to serve particular groups of people, when they're not serving them, rather than looking at themselves and saying, what's wrong with our service? Why isn't it working? They actually blame the service user. And they say things like they're not motivated to change, they're disruptive, they're unruly, they're challenging, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. People who are living in chaos and crisis and violence and drug use and poor mental health are not happy. They want it to be different. They're really struggling on their own to make it different. They really want to use your service. So you need to make it work for them. And that's what a trauma at its most basic level, it understands that. And then fully trauma-informed service adopts that into all of its policies and procedures. And what it also does is it looks after its staff. So if you have staff who are working with a client group that are likely to be highly traumatized, so they often present as aggressive or frightened or challenged, people get burnt out from that. People get burnt out from caring. People get burnt out from, particularly in services where you can have a lot of death. And a lot of, you know, sometimes people who've experienced a lot of adversity, you know, they might go to treatment and it mightn't work the first time or the second time or the third time or the fourth time. They might need to go six or seven times. So sometimes people in services experience, who work in services experience a lot of disappointment and frustration. So a trauma-informed service recognizes that the work has an impact on the staff, and they look after the staff as well.
I've been... lucky enough to speak to Johan Galtung a couple of times, and he's the originator of the phrase structural violence. And a lot of this comes from being born into structural violence. And then as you progress through life, everything is set up against you. Everything is set up against you. Is the solution here to tackle the core problem, which is state services which aren't fit for purpose or which traumatize people in themselves?
Absolutely. I mean, if you don't provide services that actually serve the people, there's no point in having them. So if you take something like, so I did a project a couple of years ago where I an ethnographic research project, which basically means you kind of live the experience. And I presented as a secret shopper to a homeless service. So I presented as homeless. So the staff were informed that somebody would arrive. And I could not believe how difficult it is, because you have to register with the Homeless Protect HPU, which is connected to the council. They were only open from 10 o'clock to 12 o'clock, and it was 11:30 when I presented at the homeless service, so I had a half an hour to get to the other side, and it wasn't going to happen. And I'm going to tell you that some of the statutory services that I had to visit, where I had to fill out paperwork, I was horrified and shocked at the way that they treated me. I watched the way that they spoke to other people. Now, I'm not going to blame the frontline staff in those organizations for that. That's a management issue. If you have staff who come into work every day and they need to treat members of the public, particularly vulnerable members of the public, really badly, then they're staff that are burnt out. And that's also a problem with the service. We have to stop this elitist, you know, looking down on others and the othering that's going on by training staff that work in those services about the complex issues that people have and how they're not mostly responsible for that, that it's actually the policies and procedures and keeping people in poverty. If you were only getting, you know, a few hundred quid a week to survive on, you're not going to be able to save up to go to university, because all of those things cost a huge amount of money. So all you have is the moment. You have no hope. You don't start thinking about in 20 years time, I'm going to have a mortgage and I'm going to have a half an acre with a pony. They're not the kind of things you think about when you're living in poverty. You were thinking about, will I have enough money tomorrow for bread and milk? And what if one of the kids comes home from school with a note because they need 25 euros for photocopy, and where am I going to get that from? And then you borrow it from another thing we need to do, which is the money lender. So you borrow it, you can't borrow it from a recognized financial institution because people won't give you any money. So you borrow it from the local money lender who now wants, you know, 99.9% interest rates on it. Yeah. So there's no getting out of that cycle then. So don't say, why aren't they thinking about education and why aren't they thinking about this? Because they are trying to survive in the moment and they are really stressed. And when you're really stressed, it produces a physiological response in your body to keep you safe. And that reduces the way your brain is able to think and your focus becomes really narrow. You can't do creativity when you're stressed. And you, in order to be able to see your way out of those problems, you need creativity and problem solving. You can't do that when you're living hand to mouth, day by day, trying your best to keep surviving. And then you end up in situations with no hope. So why wouldn't you use drugs? Why wouldn't you drink? Because it's the only thing that you probably have that makes this week okay.
And we see that reflected in the in the ages that people die at is so localized to whether you come from a wealthy area or you come from a deprived area. I mean, Limerick, I think, is it 8 years behind South County Dublin? I mean, that's a massive difference in life expectancy. This is all, again, fed into the inequality, the built-in inequality in it.
But even things like accessing healthcare. I think I've spoken about this before in public. I have a daughter who's had a couple of medical issues, and last year she had a checkup with her cardiologist, and over the, we'll say the appointment came and it was for 8 months' time. So I stuck it on the fridge, and that annoys me. You know, when you get an appointment and it's for like, and I'm like, how am I supposed to remember that? But anyway, it was for 8 months' time. And in that period of time, we got six other letters about that appointment. So it was like urgent notice on the top, and it was highlighted. And, you know, your appointment at 10 o'clock on such and such a date has now been moved to 10:15. As if when you turn up at 10 o'clock, you're going to be seen at 10 o'clock anyway. So please don't waste my time by sending me that letter. But what happened then, we got about six of them, and two of them were posted on the same day. So we were sitting there with six letters, and between us, we added it up. Between us, we had something like 12 years in university between myself and my husband. And we're sitting there looking at all of the letters. Neither of us could figure out what time that child had her appointment on that day. And, you know, if you think about, so then you have the luxury of being able to attend the appointment. You know, so you have two people who are working. We've only got two children. One can take one child, one can take the other one. We both have a car. It's very expensive to park in the hospital. If we arrive at 10 o'clock and our appointment isn't until 12 o'clock, my husband can afford it. He's not under pressure to be anywhere. He can go into the little coffee shop with the kid and all that. And then we turn up for our appointment. If you take what's involved in just turning up for a medical appointment, I can see why so many people don't. And then we blame them for failing to attend. When actually, I think you need a PhD sometimes to actually figure out where you're supposed to be and at what time.
Some of this comes back to a very simple thing that we've championed on this for a long time now, and not so much us, but other people who we've been lucky to talk to, Nuno Capaz, Tony Duffin, all of these great people, Osno Carroll, and all. And, you know, it's a lot of this is also about, you know, some of this, you made the point about being dehumanized or being othered when you present to homeless services. And I go back to what Mary McAuliffe told us nearly 3 years ago on the podcast, that we convict the poor of poverty far too often in Ireland. And a lot of these issues are dealt with still through the criminal justice system, and they need to be dealt with as healthcare issues. And if we were to just move that mentality, that could change a whole mindset for a lot of people and open up other avenues of treatment. You know, the people who come and this nonsense of like, well, we're going to give them one shot. Well, the people who get one shot tend to be, I have to tell you, the sons and daughters of people who can afford to get the help then after they get their one shot, not the person who doesn't. And then the last thing I'll say on it is that all we're doing here is, and I'm afraid, because I know we've got a new minister involved, and I've seen some of his talk, and it sounded very much like the war on drugs nonsense again. And we can't have that. We can't go backwards because every time they've changed a new minister and he wants to play hardball. And that would be my big concern, that we're coming up against this mentality that you know, well, we just didn't fight the war on drugs hard enough.
The war on drugs is the war on the poor. That's make no doubt about it, because, you know, are we allowed to talk about Golfgate? So let's take Golfgate for a second. So 81 affluent, mostly white men, rocked up and had a bit of a shindig, right? What we need to be talking about is ethics. Ethics in politics, ethics in journalism, ethics in the criminal justice system, and not having a continuous cycle of one rule for them and one rule for us. Because let's be clear, that's what's happening here. So 81 of them turned up and they had a shindig. Imagine if 20 young people from north inner city Dublin or from the north side of Cork, imagine if 20 of them were at a function room in a hotel. You see how quick that'd be shut down. And we'd all be talking about it on social media. They're a disgrace. And what would you expect? Because they're from that area. Why don't they go out and get jobs? And then if you go and you look at those 81 people who are at that function and look at how much money they earn,
I just come in at how much money they're paid, not that they earn. I always find that very, I like to caveat that all the time.
Yes, that is how much money they are paid. It's obscene. And then, you know, you expect somebody who earns, you know, 10 euros an hour to abide more strictly by the rules than you were required to. And if you think about, you know, there was some conversation in relation to treating drug use as a health issue, which it is. Drug use at a point to which somebody is dependent and it is causing them all sorts of problems in their life. That's a mental health issue. So if you, you know, there was talk, and it's in our national drug strategy that drugs are going to be treated as a health issue. Mm. So then they had, you know, a group come together and they said, well, let's give them three strikes and they're out. So let's think about that for a moment. So if I'm using heroin, and I have three strikes, are you out? I could use all of those three in one day. So if I'm walking down Patrick Street in Cork and a guard stops me and I'm in possession of heroin and they take that bag of heroin off me and I get my first strike, I'm dependent on physically and psychologically dependent on heroin. If I don't use it, I will get really sick. So I'm now going to have to go and get another bag of heroin. So I And I have to do that. If I don't do that, I will become really, really ill. And it's not like I can, you know, the minute the guard stops me, I can ring up service and say, right, I'm after getting in trouble today. I need to get into treatment. That's not how it works. It takes months and months and months to get into treatment. And for some treatment services, they ask people to jump through absolutely ridiculous hoops. And if they were able to jump through those hoops, they wouldn't need to go into treatment in the first place. So you're going to, these ideas and these concepts about decriminalization for chronic long-term drug users, so that they can get their lives back on track and they can have recovery, it's an insult then to turn around and say, oh yeah, okay, three strikes and you're out. You're right. That's the young fella who gets caught at the electric picnic with a bag of weed and, you know, three or four yolks or whatever it is young people take these days. I believe it's mostly cocaine now. So, you know, whatever it is that, you know, they're doing, and they'll go home and mommy and daddy will be really cross at all that kind of thing. But it's not going to stop them going to university. It's not going to stop them getting a job. So we're supposed to be designing these rules to help the people who need them the most. But yet when you take a step back, it's the people who need it the least who are going to benefit the most.
Yeah.
So that's what we need to be talking about is ethics.
And we see that quite a lot. We have seen, I don't know how many politicians at this stage have admitted to drug use. And, you know, it's seen as a one-off or something that was part of growing up. But if they had been born into, we'll say, Summerhill or the north side of Cork, they face that every day. That's in your face every day. And it's much more difficult to not partake when it is all around you. It is everywhere around you. How come there is such a disconnect between people who have used drugs and other people who use drugs? How can we have that big disconnect over what drug use is or how we perceive drug use?
Because they think that they're better than everybody else, because they think that they're more elite, and they think that people who are poor and who live in flats and who use loads of drugs are not good enough. They don't like their surnames. They don't like their accents. They don't like the baggage that they might bring. They don't like how outspoken they are sometimes. And actually, Lynn Ruane, you know, when she says people like you.
Yeah.
That's it. That's what it's about. It's people like you. Your face doesn't fit. I don't like your accent. I'm important. I'm special. I get to take drugs at a nice dinner party where we have expensive wine. I don't like the way you take your drugs in your crappy council house drinking out of cans. My drug use is much nicer than yours. So it's not comparable.
I tell you, I'm going to say this because I've not even finished it yet, but I'm going to recommend to listeners the new book by Isabel Wilkerson, Caste, The Lies That Divide Us. And it's amazing about how it deals with class and how the caste system that we always think of it automatically as something that just operates in India. It's not. It's global. And it is in that dinner party circle. It's in that, you know, that old Victorian mindset. It's in all of those issues and how it filters down. And ultimately, you know, there's a lot to be said. It takes out the race issue and deals with it in terms of, you know, class and mobility and access to it and how all of that evolution. I just wanted to say it's a fabulous book. I want to recommend it. Just the very last thing for me, if we were to somehow seize control for 48 hours or something, Sharon, what would be the couple of things that you think we should focus on straight away?
My first thing would be having trauma-informed public services. So that would be education, justice, and healthcare, so that people who are struggling and who've experienced a lot of difficulties, when that little person is 5 or 6 and they come into primary school and their behaviour is viewed as challenging, that people recognise that it's not challenging behaviour, that this is a little child who's upset and they don't know how to tell you, so they have challenging behaviour. One of the biggest protective factors for young people is education. There are way too many people in our country who are not able to stay in education, and the education system sometimes blames the child as opposed to saying the model that we have doesn't fit this kid. So, you know, examples are the Cork Life Centre in Cork, and they did a documentary not so long ago on Virgin Media, and that's they wouldn't call themselves trauma-informed school, but and there's loads of organizations, and you know, sometimes you hate those new buzzwords, trauma-informed, but there are organizations that you walk into and you feel it in your core. You walk in and you say, the staff here love the young people. They love them. It's not more than, you know, oh, I'm going to be respectful. It's more than that. They love them and they adore them and they want them to do well. So trying to keep young people in education, and then for the adults who are in the criminal justice system and trying to access health services, that they can actually access the services that they need and that they can use them, and that the services stop putting up so many barriers to them. And the other thing that we need urgently, really urgently, is dual diagnosis services. So people with mental health issues and addiction issues find somewhere that they can go where they feel safe and they get looked after, because people talk about the cycle of addiction. There's no such thing as a cycle of addiction. There's a cycle of trauma. So if you have a parent who's in addiction and they have ended up in the criminal justice system, and if they've died, and then the young person coming up along doesn't get the help that they need, and then they end up in substance dependence to manage their own pain, we say, oh, it's a cycle of addiction. It's not. It's a cycle of trauma. And the only way we're going to be able to address that is by giving people opportunities to access the things that allow them to grow: education, health, and employment. Stop treating people like crap. It's not, you know, trauma-informed is based on neuroscience. But actually, if you take all that away, what we're actually asking you to do is have a little bit of humanity, have a bit of compassion. Unfortunately, there are some people who don't get that. So in order to sell them the concept, you have to talk about the neuroscience, and there's very strong neuroscience behind trauma-informed. But actually, even if you take that away, stop being horrible and judgmental and treating people like crap so that they can come out of the hole that they're in, a hole that they didn't create themselves, by the way.
Sharon, thank you so much for that. I think that is the perfect end to a very good podcast. I hope you keep doing the work you're doing. It's great work, and it is genuinely helping people. Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you, guys.
Listen, folks.
Back to bed, Martin.
Yeah. He wrapped that up, guys, because he's just dying to get back to bed. No, listen, if you could head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, it's the price of a cup of coffee. It keeps this show on the road, also other shows. And you know what? I'm actually staggered by the quality of the people we get to work with and talk with all the time. This was a great conversation. Thanks so much, Sharon.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.